Welcome to the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast series sponsored by the Amerika-Zentrum Hamburg. I'm your host, Douglas Cowie. I'm a writer and teacher. In each episode of this series, my guests and I will discuss a work of literature set primarily in Chicago. This episode, we'll be discussing The Adventures of Augie March by Saul Bellow, and my guest today is Riley Moore. Riley Moore is a student at Royal Holloway University of London studying English and philosophy, and the editor-in-chief of the founder of the independent newspaper of Royal Holloway. He has written for the Daily Iowan, Quillette, the Fordham Observer, the Fordham Ram, and Marion West. He has interviewed the likes of DJ Taylor, John Sellers, and Zachary Leader. Welcome, Riley.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a real pleasure. So as I said, today we're going to discuss The Adventures of Augie March by Saul Bellow. And thinking about this novel, which we'll get to shortly, Riley, it's notable that so Augie March himself is a first generation Russian Jewish Chicagoan, and Saul Bellow himself is a first generation Russian French Canadian Jewish Chicagoan. And so maybe it's worth discussing a little bit like who Bellow is or was, and we can move from that and talking about the kind of overlaps between his life and the book itself, and talk about Chicago itself in the novel as well.
Certainly. Yeah. I think actually the most important biographer in this area is Zachary Leader, who I had the pleasure to interview. So almost all the information that I'm going to disclose about Bellow has its roots in Leader's work. Okay, well, with that being said, I think it may be best to introduce Bellow zoomed out and then zoom in to certain particulars. So zoomed out, Bellow is the most decorated writer in American history. So he won 3 National Book Awards, he won the Pulitzer Prize, and he ultimately won the Nobel in 1976. Okay, with that being said, it's somewhat coincidental that when he emigrates to the United States illegally with his family, they come from, he's born in Lachine, Quebec in 1915. His family prior to that, Abraham Bellow, his father, had immigrated from Russia. They lived beyond the pale. And so they immigrate to Lachine, Quebec for better financial opportunities, and then do the same to Chicago in 1924. And Bellow actually comes to Chicago on the 4th of July in 1924. So his American... The American facts about his life are really unending.
They're as American as it can possibly be.
Exactly. So he enters the country from Canada illegally. And the reason why I emphasize the illegal part is because that comes up as a relevant fact in his life later when he tries to be inducted into the Second World War. And that really sets the premise for his first book, Dangling Man, because the Dangling Man can't He can't serve in war, and he can't really get a job because he feels too ashamed to get a job in the midst of his own generation risking their lives. So he just kind of dangles there. But to back up to his youth and his upbringing, he lives really as a low-class Chicago boy, very much like Augie. And so the adventures that you get in Augie March have very close parallels to Bellow's actual biography. But it's worth noting that the big personalities that appear in Augie that are almost Dickensian in size, almost all of them have a real life corollary. But these characters are kind of put in the tank or in the bank, really, so to speak, because he doesn't use them immediately. He graduates to a literary style of Dangling Man that he said was a kind of correct or good writing because he was trying to impress the Partisan Review crowd. And he wanted to prove, in his own words, that a young Jewish boy from Chicago could claim the world's attention.
Right. So this is like he's writing for what he thinks others expect him to write like in order to prove that he's kind of their literary peer or something like that. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes. And in fact, you know, he's writing, although he's doing that, like you said, he's writing in a way for approval, writing correctly. You know, when he goes to the University of Chicago, he's going there to study anthropology. And he studies anthropology because he actually does have a passion for the field, but he always found himself bookish. He always found himself writing. In fact, his anthropology professor said that his essays sound like short stories. And that was part of the reason as to why he was prompted in that direction, because he felt the confidence to do so. But when he finishes his BA in anthropology at the University of Chicago, he then applies for an English master's at Northwestern. The real hurdle that Bello runs into is that the head of the English department at Northwestern told Bello that he was not born to it, the it being the English tradition, because he was Jewish. Right, exactly. So that you get a taste of the era in which we're in.
The obnoxiousness like in which he's operating.
Right. So with that in mind, this is going to come up when we talk about, you know, if Augie in some way seems to have a chip on his shoulder in certain areas. Well, Bello had that same chip on his shoulder. He was very critical of people who mistook him for not being a writer after that moment. I remember in one instance, a woman at a cocktail party had come up to him and said, and this story is later retold, actually, in a short story of his, a woman came up to him and said that he looked like an archaeologist. And he said, well, you look like someone I just dug up. So he was very prone to insult if he felt in any way slighted because he was Jewish. And, you know, understandably so. But, you know, a lot of times innocent people who have just pure intentions get caught in the crossfire of this, you know, this type of personality. But it's worth noting that, so he writes these two first novels, Dangling Man and The Victim. The Dangling Man comes out in 1944. The Victim comes out in 1947. And he called them his MA and his PhD in writing, is how he often referred to it. It's kind of a funny way to refer to it because those novels in themselves are great novels. So just to kind of discard them as beginning work in his mind. But he really launches his Belovian style in Augie March. He offloads this need to be influenced and this need to impress, and he writes a story really on the basis of a childhood friend of his named Charlie August. And so he imagines what Charlie August's upbringing would look like by borrowing from his own upbringing. This is why Augie March has a very similar sounding name to Charlie August. There's that.
I should point out, this is 1953 this novel was published, right?
That's correct. 1953. He starts it in 47. Mm-hmm. So it takes him a long time to write. I remember when he had finished it, he wrote a letter to his friend saying, Augie is finished. Thank God, is what he said. So, in the beginning, if you would prefer, I could trace the specific origins of Augie March because they are important, actually.
Before we do that,
let's just
go get a sense for people who haven't read this novel of like what the actual story of Augie March is. I want to come a little bit later to its famous opening, but
Well,
the story of Augie March is basically this kid who grows up in a pretty poor tenement building with his mother and grandmother and brothers in Chicago and kind of scraps around, you know, living by his. It's basically a picaresque novel that takes him through his upbringing in Chicago. He ends up working for a kind of mid-level, I would say, gangster called Einhorn. He gets involved in all kinds of, as the novel title suggests, adventures. I don't want to talk about all. There's like genuinely far too many to mention, but you know, various criminal activity. He ends up living with a rich family in Evanston for a bit. He ends up leaving, working in Michigan, and is it Saugatuck or somewhere on the Michigan coast? For a bit, and then he ends up leaving Chicago and going down to New Mexico and Mexico. And by the end of the novel, he's been in Europe and he's back in Chicago. The novel kind of explodes with all these things that one uncharitable critic of it said, like, you know, it's full of all this language and the kind of Belovian thing that you alluded to, but also it's really boring, which I think is not fair. I think it's not a boring novel. I think it has its boring moments for sure. But like, all in all, it's not a boring novel. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about it. But
right.
But it is this kind of it explodes in a series of events that don't really add up to a plot in a way that, like, it's, you know, here's this obvious beginning and this obvious middle that builds to a climax and has an end. You know, it's not that kind of novel. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and as a reader, you're sort of left to put all this stuff together. And I bring this up now because I suppose it reflects what you're about to say about,
yes,
the way this stuff has been put into a locker, all this stuff he's experienced has been put into a locker, and then he starts taking it out and building it into this kind of, you know, fictional masterpiece.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, it really is very difficult to get, you know, whoever has to write the jacket summary of Augie March, I don't envy their job. You know, when Bella was asked, what is Augie March about? He famously said, it's about 200 pages too long, is what he said.
I agree.
And he's and he's referencing really a certain 200 pages in the novel. not the last 200 pages. And we can get into, you know, we can get into the Mexico section in depth later, but
I was going to say for people who have read the novel and also for people who don't, it's got something to do with Mexico and an eagle.
Yeah, that's definitely, Bello had a voice what he had and with Augie March, and he didn't have a direction. So he had a personality and he had a voice. And Bello would often abandon manuscripts that were 100 pages deep to start something else, because his writing was such that he would have this spree of like a few weeks where he would just have a voice. He'd end up after those 100 pages looking up, kind of taking his head out of the water and have no idea where he was at. No
like,
direction.
Oh, this isn't going anywhere.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And in a sense that Augie March is a series of those bursts of 100 pages. I mean, such that, you know, originally when the book came out, it was supposed to come out as part one, and then a few years later it was going to be part two, but his publisher decided that it should just be wrapped around in one volume. And because of that, he cut about 200 pages of the novel. So, yeah, so Augie March, the copy that I have is about 600 pages. Yeah. Originally would have been something like 800 pages. But yes, truthfully, the voice is so sparkling and the characters are so huge that in a sense it does away with the need for plot, at least in my estimation.
That's interesting because go ahead.
Oh, no. Essentially, so those huge personalities, like you said, the mobsters that he works for or the half-mobsters that he works for, or his brother Simon is a huge, one of my favorite characters in all of literature.
Really fascinating
so
character.
So funny. So funny and violent and... Yeah. So American. My argument is that he's the most American character. Yeah. Exactly. What were you saying, sorry?
Well, what was I saying? About the voice and it's a tricky thing, like as a writer and teacher of writing, I'm always wary of that idea, you know, like you can just power through this on the steam of your voice. But like with this novel, I think this novel shows both that can be done if you're a genius like Bello, which most of us aren't, right? But also that even there, it shows the kind of pitfalls. Like it's only the kind of drive of his voice that gets you through those couple hundred pages with the eagle in the desert and everything. And like, and you're like, I know something, like I've taught this novel a few times and that, you know, students always struggle with that because like why am I reading this, like, and you've been taken on such a ride. And I think there is a real plot, force of plot and story in the opening, you know, few hundred pages of the novel, where before that it's almost like you get worried that it might never get back on track, and it does get back on track. But you know, anyway, that's like a maybe not the conversation for us today, but it's something for people to think about when they're reading it if they haven't already. But I want to talk about this voice, and maybe once we've talked about the voice a bit, we can start circling back around to some of these like really Chicago characters who populate this novel. Because you know, the idea of a Simon, the kind of charming jerk, being the most American of characters, it also makes him a very Chicago character. And this is the opening paragraph of this novel. I am an American, Chicago born, Chicago, that somber city, and go at things as I have taught myself, freestyle, and will make the record in my own way. First to knock, first admitted, sometimes an innocent knock, sometimes a not so innocent. But a man's character is his fate, says Heraclitus, and in the end, there isn't any way to disguise the nature of the knocks by acoustical work on the door or by gloving the knuckles. I mean, that's it's a, you know, one sentence or two sentence opening paragraph, and it's the whole novel is there, actually. You know, the whole impetus of the novel, I'm going to go about this freestyle in the way I want to. And like, let's see what happens. I'm going to keep knocking. I'm not sure what the knocks are, but you're going to know what they mean when you hear them, no matter how elegantly or I try to hide them or surprise, you know. It's that's the voice. I mean, it's all there. I'm an American, Chicago born, strikes me as like just a statement of intent. And he calls it that somber city. And I wonder whether sometimes when I think about this novel, whether the Chicago that he portrays in this novel really is the somber city that he claims it in that opening sentence. And I'm never convinced it quite is. It's a pretty lively place in The Adventures of Augie March.
I certainly agree. I mean, in fact, now that we're saying it now, I don't even know if Augie himself believes that, that it is a somber city. Because oddly enough, Chicago features so boldly in the novel, it's almost another character. Yeah, it lives by its own rules. Because you have, Bello really brings it to life in various physical places like the pool room. Is where it comes alive most potently with William Einhorn runs a pool room, and Einhorn is described as a small town Machiavellian, where he's constantly has an appetite for information, no matter how minor it is. So if it's baseball, if it's who's recently locked up, if it's the presidential election, he wants to know these things. And so people are always bringing him scraps of information. And it's worth noting that Einhorn is really portrayed as just a mind, because he's paralyzed from the neck down, and he has small use of his hands, but other than that, he's physically carried around by Augie, and that has actual real life parallels.
There's this amazing scene before you start talking about the real life parallels of it's really tender. It's like one of the, like, there's some really tender scenes in this novel, and one is when Augie like goes to the lake, because there's these recurring, when you start talking about enough Chicago novels, there's certain places and images that recur regardless of how different the writers are in these things. And the pool hall is one of them. Like, the pool hall is important, or like the tavern with the pool table is important in Algren and Richard Wright. Like, it comes up again and again. And the other one, James Farrell as well, Studs Lonergan. And another one that comes up again and again for very obvious reasons is the lake, you know, Lake Michigan. And there's this tender scene, to kind of finally come to my point, that where Augie helps Einhorn sort of bathe or swim in the lake. And it's like a really, there's this, you know, this crooked guy who really likes Augie a lot, and who Augie really admires, and who doesn't really quite want Augie to admire him as much as he does, because he thinks he's got better things to do than live the life that he's living. And they just have this really, it's just a really beautiful scene in the lake, literally in the lake. But talk a bit more about what you were going to. I'm just like basically footnoting everything you say, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, perhaps another point that should be stressed about this novel, and then I'll go back to the biographical parallel to Einhorn, is that Augie is fatherless in this novel, technically fatherless, as in his father's not around. And his mother, Mama, who he adores, is not an authoritative figure. She doesn't have much grasp or influence over his life. And in fact, Augie, very early into the novel, has to start taking care of her instead of the reverse. So this fatherlessness leads Augie to kind of have, I think he says, there's something very adoptable about me. People, yeah. And in one instance, people actually do want to adopt him. There's the Renling family in Michigan who would like to adopt Augie, who he refuses. But nevertheless, Einhorn becomes for Augie a kind of father-like figure. And Einhorn, you know, he has his own personal calculations for these things, but I do think he has genuine feeling for Augie. I mean, at some point they have a somewhat soured relationship, but nonetheless, he shows up to his I believe it's Simon's wedding and so on and so forth, things like that. But there's two other points I want to make before getting to the biographical contact here, which is an important fact for Augie March is, and an important biographical fact for Bello, is this is before Bello has multiple ex-wives. So Bello had married five times in his life. All right, so this is he's a serial monogamist is what he described himself as. Okay, well, that being said, the ex-wives feature prominently in a lot of his other fiction, and this mm-hmm. is before all that. So this is kind of more upbeat. The portrayal of women in this novel is a lot more powerful. They're a lot less cliched in this novel, yeah. I would say, than in other novels.
So I've made the argument before that in the first four or five chapters of this novel, the women are the most important and most powerful characters, like Grandma Lausch, who's like becomes the kind of de facto mother in his life, is like she's the authority. She's the kind of moral home authority for him. And her death her death is a really interesting moment in the novel, because he mentions it in passing, I think at the end of a chapter. He's like, oh, but by then Grandma Lausch had caught pneumonia and died. And then like the chapter ends, and then you read the next chapter, and like it's only 20 pages later that you actually get the narrated moment where Augie learns of this. So he's like, the way in which he's emotionally displaced it as part of the plotting of the novel. And then when it does, it's like he says like about how it stabs him right into the guts or something, like because he's so distraught that she's died. My point is that I think the women are the powerful figures. They become less so as the novel goes on, I suppose. But it's an interesting dynamic for sure.
Definitely. I mean, in fact, you know, we're bringing up so many characters. If people think we're being scattershot about this, it's because the novel is this way.
Scattershot about it.
Yeah. So there's so many characters to talk about, and they're brought up and in and out, and they later reappear. But yes, just for the grandma figure, yes, that they did have, Bello did have growing up a boarder who was very much like this woman, Grandma Lausch. And I think one of if somebody wants to get a ledge on her personality, Bello wrote in Augie March that grandma's memory specialized in misdemeanors, is how he put it.
That's such a great phrase. And,
yeah.
And also a very recognizable like character trait. Right, like you know exactly what he means. You and as soon as he says that, you can like imagine any number of people that you've met in your life, or who have been like, or even in your own family or whatever, who are like that kind of person.
Exactly. Yes, it's kind of old world, old generation anger, Old Testament anger almost. But to latch back onto Einhorn, so Einhorn as a character, he has roots in real life. So Bello had his best friend growing up. His name was Sam Freifeld, was his name. And Sam, characteristics of Sam show up in the novel in different areas, but there's never a character in Augie that you could say, or that Sam could say, was him. But that's not true of Sam's father, Ben Freifeld. Ben Freifeld did own a pool room. He was, you know, had an appetite for massive information, no matter what, if it's lowbrow, highbrow, whatever it may be. And he was paralyzed from the neck down and could only use his hands. And Bello, growing up, would do things like carry this man on his back, you know, walking around and so on and so forth if his friend Sam was too tired. So I believe Bello said about Ben Freifeld, the origin of William Einhorn, was that he was too special of a person to be held by oblivion. So he had to be made permanent in some way. And the way to make him permanent was to make him as William Einhorn. So this father-like figure in Augie was a somewhat father-like figure for Bello. And so the grandma-like figure for Augie, who is this kind of authoritative voice in the household, was like that for Bello. But I will note that in Bello's household, his father, Abraham, was a very active father, not to be mistaken for a generous or light-handed father, but he was active. He was there. He was working often, but you know, there's spurts, especially during the Depression, where he's unemployed, so he's around the kids and so on and so forth. So
Anyway, but he's a man raising his children. He's not like a deadbeat dad. Because the Augie March's dad is a deadbeat dad, and there's this this moment where Einhorn says something about his mother, Augie's mother, being a widow, and Augie's really grateful to him for in fact, I've literally got it open in front of me at the moment. Einhorn's giving him advice, and he says, I only ask if you have real impulses from the bottom, and I don't believe you do. Now, for God's sake, Augie, stay away from those thieves. I'd give you $20 for your widowed mother if you asked me. Did you need it so badly? No. It was kindness of him. It was kindness itself of him to call Mama a widow when he knew she really wasn't. And it's like there's little moments like that all the way with all kinds of characters in this novel, but like that. I'm going to read a little bit more later from the same scene because I think it's a really key moment. These couple of pages in partly in what the novel is trying to do and what it's about, but like, and one of those things is the tenderness of this relationship and the generosity of this man who just really likes Augie. But anyway,
yes, I mean Einhorn almost seems minus Augie allergic to being touching or tender because he has a perception to keep up, which he's built himself from the ground up. And yes, in that same scene, I do want to return to that scene because it is a very important scene. And then Einhorn ends up giving a speech to Augie that's just absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean that speech. It'll be interesting to hear what you have to say about because I've got a few different ideas about it, about what it's up to, and some things that it says about other novels that we've discussed in this series already. And let's just talk about it now. We're here.
Yeah, let's go for it.
so let me continue a bit, and then maybe I'll get you to read the speech. Einhorn sort of talking Augie out of some, you know, being a thief, as you've heard, and he says this: all of a sudden, I catch on to something about you. You've got opposition in you. You don't slide through everything. You just make it look so. It's a really interesting, like, this guy has pinpointed exactly Augie's personality. And this is like, you know, his character is his fate. And he's just put his fingertip on Augie's character. And you never really hear much about Augie's character or how it's his fate after that famous opening paragraph. You're kind of left to put these pieces together yourself. And it's like part of the joy of the novel and the fun of the novel is thinking about that all the way through and thinking about what it means. And he says, anyway, this is what the narration from Augie says. It says, this was the first time that anyone had told me anything like the truth about myself. I felt it powerfully. That, as he said, I did have opposition in me and great desire to offer resistance and to say no, which was as clear as could be, as definite a feeling as a pang of hunger. You see this play out in the plot, such as it is of this novel, again and again and again. And, you know, again, it's moved this kind of complex tenderness of this relationship is all there. And there's just a few little lines between them there.
Yes.
I should read the next paragraph, sure, I suppose, sure, as well. Sure. And then I'll hand over to you to do the don't be a sap Augie speech, which I'm a bit jealous of not being able to read myself, but you know, that's my magnanimity. Anyway, I'm being magnanimous. The discoverer of this, who had taken pains to think of me, I was full of love of him for it. But I was also wearing the discovered attribute, my opposition. I was clothed in it, so I couldn't make any sign of an argument or indicate how I felt. It's awesome. It's so, you know, this guy's like absolutely bursting with love, but just standing there like kind of nodding, going, uh-huh. And then he gets, and then he hears this from Einhorn.
Yeah, he says, don't be a sap, Augie. Yeah, this people who haven't read Augie, this really does this summarize what Einhorn, one of the principal characters, thinks of him. After Augie had done a stick-up job or a robbery with his friend Gorman, Joe Gorman. Okay, so this is what Einhorn says. He says, don't be a sap, Augie, and fall into the first trap life digs for you. Young fellows brought up in bad luck like you are naturals to keep the jails filled, the reformatories, all the institutions, what the state orders bread and beans long in advance for. It knows there's an element that can be depended on to come behind bars to eat it, or it knows how much broken rock for macadam it can expect, or who it can count on to break it, and who it can expect for treatments at the Public Health Institute. From around here and similar parts of the city, and the same in other places throughout the country, it's practically determined. And if you're going to let it be determined for you too, you're a sucker. Just what's predicted. Those sad and tragic things are waiting to take you in. The clinks and clinics and soup lines know who's the natural to be beat up and squashed, made old, pooped, farted away, no purposed away. And if it should happen to you, who'd be surprised? You're a setup for it.
What a speech.
So,
yes, that's going on here. It's,
exactly, exactly. So Augie is the sap, obviously, in this paragraph, who's really getting it told to him. Although you've been stuck in low income conditions, don't be lowbrow about things. Don't be too street. Don't let your intellectual life be decrepit. Don't let it be unnourished, because in a sense, it is expected for people like Augie, who run with people like Joe Gorman, who, you know, and in fact, Einhorn grills Augie for the fact that Joe Gorman probably had a gun. And Augie says, well, no, he didn't have a gun. And Einhorn says something along the lines of, you can tell me right now he didn't have a gun. Tell me right now. And Augie just goes silent. He can't say anything because he doesn't know, in fact, if Joe Gorman had a gun during the robbery. So, you know, there's multiple things that are floating in my head right now as to say about Augie's character and if Einhorn is sizing him up correctly. I think perhaps Einhorn is being overly harsh but necessary, I think.
That's what I was going to say.
Because I don't think that Augie, left to his own devices, would end up in prison. I think he's a bit too scheming to end up in prison, but he could accidentally end up there for, you know, a significant portion of his life because he's just hanging around the wrong people.
Yeah. He's a bit naive still here.
Yes. Yes.
And that's kind of what that it's the that long speech twinned with the you've got opposition in you. You don't slide through everything. He's partly telling him his character in order to force him to be self-aware about it and be like, so don't slide through everything. You just slid through this thing because someone came to you and you didn't give any opposition to it. So you know, be your character and determine your fate with your character. You know, that's implicit behind it. The other thing that's interesting to me about this speech is that it's a very from a kind of more literary critic perspective, I suppose, is that it's a real challenge to a lot of the other literature of Chicago in particular that precedes this novel. So I've mentioned them already, some of them anyway, like the James Farrell, Theodore Dreiser, Richard Wright, Nelson Algren, this naturalist school of literature where people are determined. Their circumstances trap them into this life no matter what they do. And, you know, characters like Frankie Machine in The Man with the Golden Arm or Lefty Beechek in Never Come Morning by Algren, Bigger Thomas in Native Son by Richard Wright, Studs Lonergan is a sap by this definition. I mean, I think he's a sap anyway, but, you know, these people live in these versions of Chicago that aren't different from Augie March's, and they all get stuck in it and trapped by it and killed by it. And, you know, it ruins their lives. Even Hurstwood, who's the upper middle class guy in Sister Carrie, gets ruined by the graft and greed of Chicago. And here Bellow is, you know, that coming back to your opening point about Bellow kind of trying to write to prove he could fit in with those first couple of novels. Like, I'm not saying he was trying to be a naturalist. I don't think that's really true, but the literary legacy of Chicago, certainly in fiction to this point, is that American naturalist, you know, inheritors of Stephen Crane and the Russian writers and Zola and kind of all in under the influence of Zola writers, which I love. I think this is my wheelhouse for literature. And here's Bellow tackling some of the same stuff and saying, like, there's something out, there's other things to be said here. And I'm just going to reread this one part. From around here and similar parts of the city and the same in other places throughout the country, it's practically determined. And if you're going to let it be determined for you too, you're a sucker. Just what's predicted. And I don't think that some of those writers didn't think their characters were suckers, but they didn't think there was any way out for their suckers. And Bellow thinks that at least this one sucker has a way out, you know, to not be a sucker. And I just think that that challenge, you know, at the end, Einhorn says, but if you think the least of the consolation prizes is the world. And that's a challenge to that fatalistic attitude of American naturalism that I think is a valuable moment in this novel. And it's a valuable thing about this novel.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think you're right that Bellow does see a way out. I mean, I think he called, I believe it's in this novel, and I think it's honestly one of the best instantiations of the American dream. He said that everyone has the universal eligibility to be noble, is what he said. And so that's what he thinks Augie is trying to realize, is this eligibility to be noble. And by noble, he doesn't mean an aristocrat. He means an intellectual.
Spirit,
I mean, someone who's... Right, exactly, exactly. And it's worth noting that Augie, this is Bellow's first really intellectual character. And by intellectual, I don't mean kind of clinical or academic intellectual. I mean someone who's so susceptible to a range of ideas and considers them honestly. And he's also, you know, mentally fit enough to consider multiple ideas. I mean, this is what Philip Roth, Bellow's good friend, called the Bellowian glide. So Bellow glides from hot dogs to Nietzsche and baseball and gangster and radios to Plato, right? So Augie's interested in all these things. And in that mind is what, in my mind, that's what makes him a particularly likable character, is because he's smart, but he's not a snob. Augie's definitely not a snob. And he thinks there's something to be said about America through the bottom up instead of through the top down. So, yeah.
Here's an illustration of exactly that. I mean, it's there in the opening paragraph. Again, I made the claim that those two sentences are the whole novel, and I stand by that claim. You know, he says, like, a man's character is his fate. Heraclitus says, you know, it's like, it's already there. Like, but here's another one. This is from about halfway through the novel, and he says, if I mentioned a Chicago junkyard as well as Charlemagne's estate, I had my reasons. For should I look into any air, I could recall the bees and gnats of dust in the heavily divided heat of a street of L-pillars, such as Lake Street, where the junk and old bottle yards are, like a terribly conceived church of madmen and its stations endless where worshippers crawl their carts of rags and bones. And sometimes misery came over me to feel that I myself was the creation of such places. How is it that human beings will submit to the gyps of previous history while mere creatures look with their original eyes? It's all there, right? Like, it's the, you know, Chicago and Charlemagne and the L, you know, another motif that runs through all of Chicago literature, the L tracks and the junkyards. But he's building it into this bigger, more beautiful thing, because it is like, you know, misery came over me to feel I myself was the creation of such places, but he is the creation of such places, and here he is not being a sap.
You know, exactly.
And he's thinking, here he is thinking, and the least consolation he has is the world that he's describing in this half a paragraph that I just read out from the middle. This is, in fact, from the boring part of the novel, I just realized, because there's the next paragraph after that is, we had a few such afternoons when we started to train the eagle. And you're like, God damn it, I don't want to train the eagle.
I'm there with you in terms of I don't want to train the eagle. I think that the Mexico section has some redeemable qualities, but to pick up on the point that you just made, I think it's the correct one, and it's Augie is almost incapable of not seeing the large personalities that he sees and not putting them in some kind of historical context. I mean, he says one of my favorite openings to one of these chapters is he said, and this is the introduction of William Einhorn. He said, William Einhorn was one of the most superior, was one of the few superior men I knew, the most superior men I knew. And he enters him on a list of Machiavelli and I think Napoleon. I think he puts him in a list of large historical personalities. And he says, I have no hesitation about putting Einhorn on this list with them. And I mean, that really gets to the point that the original title of The Adventures of Augie March was Life Among the Machiavellians, is what it was titled. And it wasn't a different story. It's the same story. It's just that was the title, the working title for a long time. before he changed it to pay homage to Twain, who actually I do want to bring up as a matter of how American this novel is, because I think it has a lot of roots in Twain. But nevertheless, I think that Augie's reference, his frame of reference, doesn't really feel like Bellow is trying to offload a lot of his own information that he knows. So it's not as if Bellow went and read a whole bunch of Marx and Kant and Plato and now wanted to fit it into the story. It was built into the prose itself. It's not something added later for seasoning to make it seem intellectual. And in fact, maybe that this would be a good segue into how the idea of the novel came about and how the language of the novel came about. So do you think I could trace that really quick in terms of...
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, yeah. So at the time, Bellow was in Paris on a Guggenheim Fellowship. And, you know, Bellow boasted that The Adventures of Augie March, which primarily takes place in Chicago, there's a stint in Mexico, a large stint in Mexico, but he boasted that he wasn't in the United States for the entirety of its composition. So, in other words, the America that he created was America out of memory. It wasn't one that he was having day-to-day experience with. Okay, that being said, he's in Paris, and he's writing a book called, possibly a novel, definitely was going to be a novella, called The Crab and the Butterfly. And this was followed two characters who, one was in the hospital and one was visiting the other in the hospital. And it was a very dreary book, and it was making him depressed. He didn't like writing it. He had a very strict schedule where he would get up, and for the first 4 hours of every day, he would write no matter what he had going on for the rest of the day. And during that time, he would blast Mozart or Beethoven in his study. And, you know, his wives all had the same account of him doing this. So we know this is an established fact. But okay, that being said, he's writing this very depressing novella, and he's walking the streets of Paris, and he sees the gutters in Paris being cleaned by municipal workers, and he sees water sparkling in one of these gutters. And it was in that sunny iridescence that he thought it was just so totally free, so totally able to go where it wants. And it's worth noting, by the way, and actually this was pointed out to me by when I interviewed Zachary Leader. He said he didn't put this point in the biography, but he wished he made this point, which was Bellow noticed water sparkling in the gutter, right? So it's something beautiful in the gutter, in other words, and the gutter being the low class, something beautiful being Augie, right? So, but you know, Bellow has this amazing retelling of it that I should read, because he told this to Philip Roth. So I'm just going to read a brief paragraph of Bellow's origin of this novel. He said, "Well, there was a touch of sun in the water that strangely cheered me. I suppose a psychiatrist would say that this was some kind of hydrotherapy, the flowing water freeing me from the caked burden of depression that formed on my soul. But it wasn't so much the water flow as the sunny iridescence. I remember saying to myself, well, why not take a short break and have at least as much freedom of movement as this running water? My first thought was that I must get rid of the hospital novel. It was poisoning my life. And next I recognized that this was not what being a novelist was supposed to have meant. This bitterness of mine was intolerable. It was disgraceful, a symptom of slavery. I think I've always been inclined to accept the depressions that overtook me, and I felt just now that I had allowed myself to be dominated by the atmosphere of misery or surliness, that I had agreed somehow to be shut in or bottled up. I seemed then to have gone back to childhood in my thoughts and remembered a pal of mine whose surname was August, a handsome, freewheeling kid who used to yell out when we were playing checkers, 'I got a scheme.'" So that kind of American can-do, "I got a scheme," is where you get Augie. And Bellow said that subject and language appeared at the same moment. So the language of Augie March, which is a kind of awkward, I don't necessarily want to describe it as awkward, because the prose is more musical than that.
Yeah.
But it kind of picks its own style.
It has its own sort of syntactic movements and ebullience, I suppose, is the word,
yes,
maybe, or one of them you could use for it. Yeah, it's, yes, mean, you hear it in almost everything we've read from the novel already, right? Like it's even hard to read some sentences because they're so long. You got to figure out where to breathe, and yeah, you know.
Yeah, the novel teaches you how to read it, honestly, as you get through it. And Bernard Malamud once made the comment to Bellow that he applauded Bellow for his ability to call all things by some name. So, in a way, everything's renamed. And by renaming it, it makes it more of Augie's own. It's kind of sure. Augie's world when he treats
sure.
it that way.
Like I'm comparing Einhorn to Machiavelli and Caesar and Ulysses. And I'm,
right.
you know, if I think of Chicago and talk about Charlemagne's palace, and like everything's constantly being given extra aura.
Yes.
But that extra aura, and I think this is one of the things that makes the novel compelling, is it's easy for a lousy writer to clamp something onto something and demand it be so, right? Like this is this image. I want Chicago to be Charlemagne's palace, and I'm going to, you know, do it come hell or high. And it's another thing to have that so organically erupt from this particular character and this particular narrator in a way that makes it so. That's like that kind of thing. I'm blanking on, for the moment on what there's a writer who talks about, like the really great poetry is the thing where you're like, I've never thought that something was this way, but now that I see you saying it, it has to be that way. It has to be so. And like, you know, and Bello's doing that. He forces you to Augie march your way through the world while he's
right.
doing it. Like, you know, that's the kind of thing that Chekhov does to you when you read Chekhov. Like suddenly you walk around the world and you're like, you have some time to get used to it after reading a bunch of Chekhov. And I think this novel does that too. Before we wrap up, I want to come back to something you said right at the beginning when we first started talking about what this novel even was, which is about Simon, Augie's brother. And you said he was one of your favorite characters, and I said he was a charming jerk. And I think those two things are not mutually exclusive. But I wonder if we should talk, because you said he's like the most American of characters, or you said something to that effect.
Yes.
And I think that's probably worth talking about a little bit.
Certainly is. Simon is kind of all Augie's got. He's Augie's most reliable friend and kind of institution, really. I mean, because at some point, Simon marries Wealthy to a woman named Charlotte Magnus in the novel. And he does this not out of love. He does this out of mere financial advancement. But I think this is really a good window, actually, into Simon's character. He marries her because her family owns a coal yard business, and he thinks he could take over that coal yard business and make a lot of money. And he does. And it's worth noting that Simon March is based on Maury Bello's older brother, who did that exact thing. He married rich so he could take over a coal yard. And Augie has this relationship to Simon such that no matter what error Simon makes, Augie will forgive him. He's got a weakness for this, and Simon knows he's got this weakness. And so Simon is just pure American materialism. He wants... And the way he treats, there's a great scene where he's at a dinner table with his wife, Charlotte, and Charlotte's mother. So it would be Simon's mother-in-law. And at some point he reaches across the dinner table and rips her dress off. And, you know, it's a big scene. Like it's like supposed to be funny, but Simon is insistent that his mother-in-law not dress, like he says, as a janitor's wife. That's just unacceptable to him. And so, you know, he sees women at the beach and he like bulls at them like he bellows at them like a bull, I think is a line. So, you know, I'm kind of painting this monster for people to get a sense of. But he's not just monstrous in terms of how brutal he acts towards other people financially, personally, but his appetites. I mean, physically, he's eating constantly. He's big, physically big. He gains a lot of weight in the novel. And so you kind of have this presence where Simon is there even when he's not there, because Augie feels his judgment. And this judgment, in my mind, is a particularly American judgment. Like, in other words, you know, you better be doing something. You better be making money. You better be climbing some kind of hierarchy. Otherwise, I will send men to beat you up.
Yeah. I mean, that starts as soon as even when they're kids, right? And they're working, right. Selling newspapers at the train station, and he's already doing that to him. It occurred to me while you were describing him that, and I don't know, I'd have to give this more scrutiny to see whether it holds up. So like I can leave this for listeners to decide for themselves, but it's, in a way, Simon is like Gatsby and Tom Buchanan rolled into one. Like, you know, like he's got that, like you say, he's there when he's not, he wants everything that is coming to him. He's not a nice guy. He holds this charming sway nonetheless. you know, I feel like I could, if I really wanted to, which I do not, I could write the essay about that.
Yeah. It's worth noting that Simon's also incredibly intelligent. He's not a brute in a kind of backyard, angry, uneducated way. And in fact, he disguises his intelligence multiple times in the novel. And this is what Maury did too, Maury Bello. So, you know, he goes over to, he sees, you know, a remembrance of things past on Augie's bookshelf. And he says, like, who's this guy Proust, is what he says, right? Knowing damn well that he'd read that book and Augie had seen him reading that book in their youth, right? So there's a role that Simon assigns himself that he's constantly playing. And this role is older brother, the role is millionaire, and the role is husband, but in a very limited way husband. Because his idea of husband is, look, I pay for everything, she should be happy, right? And obviously that's just the perfect recipe for an unhealthy, toxic relationship. So, yeah.
So I guess as we wrap up here, it's worth like trying to bring some shape around everything that we've been talking about. You said earlier, you know, if it sounds like we're skipping around, it's because the novel skips around. You know, I said earlier, it's a picaresque adventure, not so much a like beginning, middle, end type of novel, but. And I mean, we've scratched the surface of it. I feel like we've given like some foundational stuff of it here, but we've really also only scratched the surface of lots of other stuff that's going on. You mentioned Mark Twain a moment ago, and that might be a useful lens to put over the end of our discussion here and talk about this novel's place in American literature more generally. Like you said at the beginning in your kind of brief biography of Bello, this guy is the most decorated novelist, writer in American history. It's like when you said that, I was thinking like, take that, Hemingway. You know, that's not nothing. And this novel's not nothing. And that opening paragraph seems to me an announcement of someone. And like, I think almost every serious American writer feels like they want to do this, but it's an announcement of someone trying to write the great American novel in that, like, which is like an idea that always has to be taken with a certain grain of salt, but is also like, it's the most American thing you can do if you're an American writer, is try to write the great American novel in that Simon March kind of way, I guess.
Yes.
And in an Augie March kind of way. And so like, you know, Twain is a candidate for that, you know, to me, the answer is always going to be Moby Dick, but there's plenty of other novels that you throw into that parlor game or whatever you want to call it, but there's something more serious behind it. You know, how do you put all those things into some kind of row?
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up this point about Twain, because I think really my idea that Augie March is the great American novel stems from the fact that Twain ushers in a particular type of American prose that I believe Bello perfected. So in essence, you know, Hemingway, to bring him up again, said once that all American literature since Mark Twain comes out of Mark Twain. And what he meant is Huck Finn, because what Twain does in Huck Finn is he introduces the spoken word into prose. So, you know, the sense of dialogue being the only area where you can put colloquialisms has been abandoned. And it's been told, in my opinion, the most first person you can get. Really with Huck Finn, because it's as individual as a voice you can get. Okay, so Bello does that, but what Bello does is he intellectualizes that voice and he puts it in a great American city and he surrounds him by great American characters. So in my estimation, that makes the novel particularly American. Now, when you say that Bello, with this first paragraph, it seems as though Bello's announcing that he's going to try to write the great American novel. I would be more hesitant to say that Bello was doing this consciously. I think that Bello really was
tired. Yeah, I don't think it matters whether he's doing it consciously or not. He's still doing it.
Sure, sure. Yeah. I think though that it would be useful for people who are approaching this book for the first time to keep in mind, like, to not over symbolize the book. So if you go to Mexico and you see Augie March with the American Eagle, well, this really isn't the kind of symbolism that most people would be prone to think about, because only because Bello was literally on his honeymoon in Mexico with an American eagle that hunted iguanas, right? So when you learn about the Bello's biographical origins, this Mexico section becomes more of an excess of Bello's need to fictionalize his biography than necessarily him trying to write the great American novel. But yes, and as far as I'm concerned, this book, as being an American book, has its origins in Twain. And as I said, I think he perfected Twain, but that's not to say that he perfected Twain's style. He perfected an integration of the spoken language into prose. So yeah, and that's where you get ushered. This ushers in the Belovian style of freewheeling. It's odd to say this because the next book, Seize the Day, is not like this at all. And he jettisons this book from his canon because he thinks it was a return to the standard by which he no longer wanted to live by. But really, since Augie March, this is the great American writer that people know.
Riley Moore, thanks so much for coming in today to talk to me about The Adventures of Augie March by Saul Bellow on the Chicago Homburg podcast series for the America Centrum Homburg. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.